Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hi, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rovecovery. I'm one of your co-hosts, Sarah Heath, and my other co-host is Justin Gentry. We'll introduce ourselves a little bit later, but I get the awesome job of getting to introduce our guest this week, which is Cortland Coffey. And if you don't know Cortland's work, he is one of the co-hosts of Thereafter with Megan Crozier, who we had on a couple weeks ago. Normally, we ask our guests, hey, like, how is it that you want to be introduced? And Cortland said, I really have no preference. I really don't mind how I am perceived. And I think that actually has a little bit to do with the story that Cortland will share with us. I will give you a little bit of a trauma activation potentially for some of you that might have grown up in some coercive control situations. We don't get into too many of the details, but this is a story about what does it mean and how do you get out of being in what some would consider a cult. And so with no further ado, I think this is a great conversation and one that really talks about how do we reconcile our past with our present and indeed our future. So Cortland, thank you so much for being on the show. This is a great conversation. Hi, friends, and welcome to another episode of Rovecovery. I'm one of your hosts, Sarah, and my co-host is...
Justin.
Justin Gentry.
I'm here.
Good it to have me. You here, buddy.
I'm awake, I promise.
You're here. We are a podcast, if you aren't aware. I'm sure you are aware because you hit play, but we're a podcast that helps folks think through transition, whether you're leaving ministry, whether you're leaving being a big-time volunteer, whether you're transitioning how it is that you see your life and work within or outside of the church community. We are really glad that you joined us this week. We have our friend Cortland this week, who has an incredible story.
Yeah, hi. That's overselling it already. You've already oversold it. incredible story.
It is.
It's a good story. So usually we start kind of like asking, how long were you in? And it sounds like prison. For you, it's probably closer to the truth than
I know.
For others. I know. And we're going to get into that. So, how long were you in ministry and what were you in for?
Share a little bit about yourself.
What were you in for?
Yeah.
So it's, I almost always used to say like 10 years, but it's kind of a confusing number because the ministry kind of fell apart and I was still stuck within this like kind of like post ministry organization with these other people that I was in ministry with that was kind of an extension of the ministry after the death of the ministry. It was like an after death ministry situation. So, and that extended to almost 10 years. Actual ministry, probably closer to like 7 years. And that started when I was 17. So again, it's kind of like the numbers trying to like really nail down where that was that started. I grew up always being super involved in ministry. I went to my pastor when I was like in like fourth grade and was like, I want to do what you do, and kind of saw myself as in ministry training from the very beginning.
And the pastor wasn't like, don't do it.
I wish had he been like, it's funny because we connected later in life and he was also post ministry and but at the time he was like, yeah, nice. This is great, you should do this.
It's nice when that happens.
I'll be honest, I did go back to some of the folks that I mentored later and I was like, hey, I'm sorry about that, because they came in and they've had great experiences in ministry and we laugh about it, but I was like, you know, it must be kind of weird to have your mentor then leave. And I again left under different circumstances than most, in that I left under pretty good. I left in a pretty good situation, so it was different. But sometimes you wonder, like, what advice did I give people? How good did I make it look? Did I make it look too good? Did I make it look too like fulfilling? You know, so that a fourth grader would come and
ask, was I lying or did I believe this? Like, was it a little bit of both? Why is this?
Yeah. So you when you started at 17 and you were very involved in a community, and you say it kind of fell apart. You want to talk a little bit about A, the community you were a part of and what falling apart looked like?
Sure. Yeah. We'll start there at the end and then work our way back like a Tarantino movie. Is that
yes.
Like,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll do it.
Because it is like a Tarantino movie if we're honest about what you've experienced.
Several people dead strung across a building in the middle of nowhere. Swords. Yeah, I don't know what else a Tarantino movie. I've only seen Kill Bill.
I walked out of Kill Bill, which is a whole other story, but keep going. I think he's a great director. That movie just
Volume one or volume two?
I don't remember. So fall apart. It had fallen apart like several times. If I had to kind of like explain the like pattern of the particular ministry that I was a part of for my, you know, 17 to 26 year old life, it was like kind of the model was like over promise, under deliver, blame somebody else, move somewhere else.
Yeah. That was the business plan.
Yeah. So okay. It was always this like really big, grandiose vision. We're going to plant this thing. It was a church planter kind of first approach with these really big aspirations. And we went through several iterations in several different parts of town trying to kind of get the right combination of sucker to kind of like go in with us on whatever this dream was that we had. Hypothetically,
this feels just like regular church planting to me based on my experience of church planting.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was big and bold. Was it connected to a denomination or was it a non-denominational experience?
We were not connected to a denomination, totally independent. If in terms of like, I guess like the vibe, like what was the Mars Hill one? What was the
Acts 29,
yeah, okay. Kind of maybe the vibe.
So like we were, super sexy musicians.
We were part of the Willow Creek Association.
Yes. Okay.
So we kind of like Bill Hybels was the apostle of like kind of like our, okay. Like we saw him as like one of our church fathers.
He's come out great. He's a,
yeah, not, like, not a complicated legacy at all.
If you are listening, you're like, why is she laughing so hard? Bill Hybels, it was revealed.
Give it a Google.
He was pretty seriously abusive in multiple and many ways. Yeah.
Who could have seen that coming?
Who could not have seen that coming?
Mm-hmm. So the very end of it was we had gotten to this place where we had over leveraged ourselves to just like the nth degree. We had bought like $1.5 million worth of land in the mountains outside of Denver, Colorado. We had committed pretty major fraud to do that. We had.
I like how you just said that, like so. And we committed fraud. So it was great.
Yeah. We had gone deeply into debt with several big projects, renting buildings, signing long term leases that we ended up having to like basically leave. Lots of people were after us for lots of money. Like the most hilarious aspect of this is like we were still trying to do church like in like an outdoor setting. At one point we bought a giant circus tent and put it up on our land because we literally had been kicked out of every building that we had ever rented because we owed so much money. And we're doing church in a circus tent in the Rocky Mountains.
I feel like it's a new low when like the creditors are knocking on the door and you're like,
but there's no door. It's canvas.
We're going to buy us a circus tent. Like when the thing that makes the most sense to you is buying a circus tent, you know, you're in deep.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And the moment when you have to pretend you're not in the tent, like you're behind canvas, there's no closed door.
No one's home. Go away.
No one's here.
So financially, like it was a giant house of cards and it had fallen apart. And then staff wise, there was a ton of just like infidelity, sexual abuse, various other like deeply disturbing things that were happening abuse wise among staff and connected people to staff. So that kind of resulted at the very end, we had gotten kicked off the land. A big chunk of us were living in the compound.
Wait, you were living not in the circus tent, obviously.
We were not living in the circus tent, but on that land.
Maybe I shouldn't hold that have said obviously.
I was going to say, hold that obviously, Sarah.
We have not reached the... I've been watching too many podcasts on cults lately, guys, because all I can think about is like, wait, you were all living together?
Yeah. Yeah. So there was a big chunk of us that were living at this compound. There was a big chunk of us that were living at another compound that we had leased that was like kind of on the other side of town. And we basically got evicted from both of those properties at the same time. So we got evicted from both those properties. We had another piece of property that we had kind of leased and that had, like, it was a friend of somebody who was an elder in our church, and they were basically giving us a deal and not like enforcing that we pay rent. And so pretty much everyone who was involved in the staff of that church at that point, minus the people who had left because of various different infidelities and abuse allegations and et cetera, all moved into this what was a formerly a dog daycare. And so this is the end of the story. So
I knew some of this story before, but it's like, it's just new flavors. Like, this is...
So hold on. Yeah. So like, we've got two places that we're living, and then there's a third that becomes available, but it's an old doggy daycare. I've seen this horror film. It's not good. And there's also a circus tent.
And this is not like, you've been doing this since you were 17.
Yeah.
So you got connected to this church. This has kind of been happening over and over. I want you to finish the story, but I want us to roll into like, at what point did you realize something was up? Because I think this is like a common thread. And in all of our stories, honestly, whether they're kind of crazy or even normal, there's a point where you realize like, wait a second. Like, and then once you kind of ask that question, it's like it all opens up. So I guess maybe finish where you're at. And then I want us to kind of pivot there.
It was unfortunately not until like very, very late that I realized like, oh, this is very abnormal.
Cortland, this is the Revcovery podcast. It's all four people that realized a little bit too late. So it's fine.
Well, I think in your defense, I think the idea of living together, if you think about that, for many of us, there is that biblical like ideal. Wouldn't it be nice if we could all share our resources? I've seen it done really well in things like the Rukba House and places like that, right? So I think we have those ideals that aren't as crazy sounding. And so we're like, oh, that's just what we're doing. And then very slowly, or not even very slowly, but it morphs into something a little bit different where all of a sudden no one's paying their bills. And we end up with no equity. And we end up trying to figure out how to move beyond something when we've literally had our actual needs taken care of. And you're sort of stuck. So you're take us to the dog daycare.
Yeah. So like we had continued to sell this con. We still had some people. The leader, and I want to try to not make it too much about him, because the leader, senior pastor, the main guy, my mentor, he could be very easily the villain in this story. And we could do a whole, Netflix type of thing. But I'm not quite comfortable making that all about him. And so, but he was still like selling this idea like, oh, we're going to come back. Now we're going to do this, new thing, because that whole thing blew up and now we're going to do this new thing. So we got someone to give us a bunch of money to help build out little living areas in this old warehouse. And it was my family and another family and kind of like two partial families that we're all living in this place, but there was no kitchen. There was one shower in like a little apartment unit on the back of the building, but there was no accessible shower for us to use, for our family to use. So it was me and my wife and my son at the time, who was my son at the time, my son,
He's
who
still
at
your
the
son.
Time was like, I don't know, three, four, something like that. And we would like go to the rec center and shower and that sort of thing. And
goodness.
Then we would like do, you know, dishes in, you know, the bathroom sink there. And like, we were basically squatting in this building because it wasn't like a building people were supposed to be living in. And so like, we had to have all of our things where we could like stack them up or set them up and make it look like storage, because it was not a building that people should have been living in.
Not zoned for people to live in.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we were basically squatting in this building, and we had no money and we had no sustainable way to get anywhere from there. And that was kind of the point where I was like, oh, this is not,
it's
like,
not
we're
healthy.
Not going to come back from this. Mm-hmm. Like, this is, we're basically unhoused at this point.
Which is such a scary thought, to think that all of a sudden all the things, because it's almost like that summer camp feeling. Like, as you're describing it, at first I'm like, oh yeah, I've worked for a summer camp where we stayed in bunk houses that weren't supposed to be bunk houses, you know, and that would be fun for max. We also didn't have 4-year-old children. But I think there is that, how would I put it? Almost like that sense that we're willing to let go of some of the like niceties, because like, oh, I don't need these luxuries. A luxury, by the way, of a bath with a 4-year-old. Anyone who has children knows that that's like, that's an important time, right? The putting your child to bed and all that sort of stuff. And so what did that feel like? And then how did you get out of it? Like, Cortland, that's all you've known.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is like, it was, so I got involved in this early on at 17. And at that point in time, it was very cool, right? Like, at that point in time, this group was living in this old house in downtown Denver. It was like an old Victorian house. It had like 6 bedrooms, only 1 shower again. It had lots of bedrooms, and it was, you know, and there was a lot of us. There was like 30 some of us at that point.
Whoa.
So there was like at least 4 young couples. There was a family with 1 toddler, and then a family with 3 young kids, and then several single guys and a couple single girls all living in this house.
Which I don't know the time frame, but like, you know, like Shane Claiborne's writing about all this and his.
This was,
you know,
2007. So this was so this, like,
right when all that's happening.
Yeah. So it's like, oh, yeah, we're doing that thing. You know, this is the thing we're doing. And maybe at that time it was like that, but it sounds like it went south or very quickly.
Yeah.
That's and what so I mean. I mean, there are intentional communities that have a different vibe, that have a good centered community, centered focus, but we're not. And it sounded like that, like, as I'm hearing you talk about it, it's 2007. I would sign up for that. I would have signed up for that in a second without realizing it.
Yeah. And so like at 17, I was coming out of an environment. So I had grown up in a super fundamentalist kind of Southern Baptist culture and had kind of like shaken off of that variety of, I was like, that's not for me. I kind of went through like a deconstruction of sorts in like 2004, 2005, reading, you know, like Shane Claiborne and Tony Campolo and, you know, like these guys who were like, oh, the church is this more radical thing, and seeing, you know, the new monastic movement and Mission Year. And, you know, I was following people like Matthew Paul Turner at the time, you know, had written Coffeehouse Gospel, and Relevant Magazine had Relevant Publishing was out at that time.
Yeah.
And it was this kind of like new radical.
It was such a cool time to be a Christian.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Yes, guys. Yeah. We looked great. Like that was before we knew invisible children were problematic. I mean,
exactly.
We were shoeless. We were making our own clothes. We were, and I was at Duke Divinity at the time. So I was the Rupa House, which I haven't followed it in a really long time, but they were a big part of the new monastic movement. And they were doing incredible things for racial reconciliation, anti-racism, helping those unsheltered. Like, it was the ideal. And I think so many people looked at that. I know I did. Although I do remember, I said I would have signed up. I do remember having that moment where I was like, you have 1 bath. So it's funny that you mentioned the 1 shower. And I thought, I was in a sorority. I don't know that I want to do that again.
I bet Jesus would have had 2 bathrooms.
I mean, maybe. I think
so.
Yeah, so I just want to assure you, Cortland, that you weren't weird for going into it.
Yeah. So I had been I had been, you remember the Jesus Radicals? Like, did you ever follow
Jesus People USA? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, the Salters were traveling around in their big black school bus playing shows with Me Without You.
Yes,
and they were dumpster diving and hopping trains. And like, that was the energy of my 16-year-old self.
And we liked the music too. That kind of fits as well, Cortland. That's what we were listening to.
Exactly. Exactly. So there was this, when I signed up to be a part of this group and moved out to Denver at 17, I had dropped out of school at 16, moved into an apartment with some buddies in Kansas City, and then didn't like the environment of living with three other high school dropouts and, you know, the people smoking weed in my house all the time, people hooking up in my bed, coming home to bong water spilled over everywhere.
Oh, no.
That was kind of like what I was like. I was like, okay, I had gotten out of my household. I had gotten out of this, like, what I thought was like this kind of Christian fundamentalism household. And I was now free and in this like young teenage, you know, punk rock phase. And I didn't like that. And that was, I was like a perfect candidate for somebody to be like, come join our cult. Like, perfect candidate.
Well, yeah. And I think a piece, I didn't mean to interrupt you and make you move beyond it, but you said you grew up fundamentalist. So you grew up or with a fundamentalist slant in your family. So you're running away from that as well. Like, you're trying to find your own grounding without a sense of like normalcy in some ways. Right. So like, it makes sense that you swing between the extremes to end up with like, oh, I recognize being around all these people that also have dropped out. This isn't the way I want my life to go. Oh, this thing looks really shiny. And it looks like the thing that we talk about, like the radicalness of, you know, what Tony Campolo talked about, right? Like, we can do this thing. We can heal the world. We can heal each other. And when you're trying to do something good, right? You're trying to be good.
Yeah. And then it was this like very slow indoctrination into, you know, this world of evangelicalism and church planting and church growth and being around a ton of people who were like, trying to build, we idolized these stories like Bill Hybels, you know, and the sunny, what did they call their youth group? There was like a youth group that Bill was leading and it had like some Sunshine Youth or something was like the name.
Yeah. Sunshine Happy Fun Times or something. I don't know.
And they were like, okay, they were like all, you know, Bill and all these young kids. Again, in retrospect, it's like, oh man, the red flags. But like Bill and all these young kids were like, you know, starting this radical thing that is now this multi-billion-dollar world-changing powerhouse.
They have a water slide at their church. Like, that's just like, just get ready for that, you know?
Well, like, and also like that era too of church planning, I would say like from like maybe 2005 to even, you know, 2015 was like, everyone thought they were going to be the next Bill Hybels. And like it kind of creates this weird environment where like you'll kind of do anything to be the next Bill Hybels.
It's like a tech startup, like everyone looking at Steve Jobs, but it's Bill Hybels and
like,
that's where Hillsong, you know, comes from. And that's where
I guess we'll sleep in the church if at the end we're Bill Hybels, like, you know, like we'll do all the things, you know, if it's going to get us the result for Jesus, of course.
1,000%. That was what it
totally
was.
Totally. You know, but like it is a weird kind of thing where you're like, oh yeah, I'll sacrifice, you know. And then like, I mean, when I went church planning, I was like kind of squatting in someone's house for a while, you know, that had moved away, and like they were like, yeah, sure, you can stay there. And then they're like, oh yeah, maybe we're gonna need you to do rent. And they were like, actually we want to sell the house, you know. So it's like, you know, but you kind of do things that you're like, yeah, that doesn't make any kind of sense at all. But it's for the Lord, so and it's being blessed. So yeah,
blessed. As you were looking around, Cortland, the writing was on the wall, right? You were saying you're kind of like, okay, this isn't what I want for my family. At this point, you're responsible and in partnership with someone else. You're responsible for a child together. And how'd you make the break?
It was very slow. because we didn't have, you know, we had basically cut off our families. We didn't have any formal education. I was a high school dropout. My wife who is still my wife to this day, she was homeschooled. We were both homeschooled kids. So it's like you're, you know, homeschool, high school dropout, no college education. You know, your entire resume is, you know, being a part of a cult for 7 years. You know, there's some translatable skills there that you could be like really good with people, you know, like, I don't know, like I don't, really good in tight situations. I don't know.
Law enforcement.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Can live very invisibly.
We joke around about the idea that sometimes it feels like when you're rewriting your resume, some of our folks that we have had these conversations with, it does feel a little bit like you're trying to translate cultish behavior into business speak. But I would argue, having worked a little bit in corporate and then dealt with startups, they're a little bit like a cult. Like, it's a little bit like you actually, some of the people that start tech companies are, I mean, look at Elon Musk, no offense, don't come at me, tech bros. But there is that like very cultish, like there's a very central leader. They make big promises under, you know, the big promises. And then under, what did you say? Oh my gosh, why can I not speak English? They're unable to actually produce what they say they're going to produce.
Yeah, they can't deliver.
They can't deliver is the word. Under
anybody who watched like the WeWork documentary.
Yes.
Like,
yes,
like that is what we did, right? So like, right. And this is what I say, like going into this interview, I told you guys, like, you're gonna have to steer me because there's like a billion different directions we could go about things that we did that were like this combination of evangelistic efforts and then also like ways to like create, like commit tax fraud, essentially. So like we started a coffee shop / you know, restaurant. We started a driving school. We actually like got a state approved curriculum to teach driver's education as a scheme to like reach kids in the community and build our youth group and make money for the ministry and funnel, like raise donations so that we could get people to donate money for the curriculum, for buying cars, etc. We started a U-Haul dealership so that we could be the first people that people moving to our community see when they come and they move and they drop off their U-Haul truck. We started a restaurant. We started a publishing company. We had a brief media company effort that we, and all of these things, we would like raise funds. It was always like, you got to get people to invest with this like spiritual spin, but it was really just a cash grab, to be honest. But like we personally, those young people who were involved in it, we were really sold on this. These things are going to change the world. We're going to use these vehicles of business innovation to like reach people for the mission. I was a big, like, true believer.
Are you having like church services during this time too? Like, is the like?
Yes, we're also doing the weekly, you know, seeker friendly service with like trying to make media and create, you know, engaging, you know, creative, big, you know, smoke machine light, you know, show type of services.
Well, that's the thing too, is I can't, I really think your story is a huge part based on and really within the way that this Christian culture shift was happening that kind of felt really good, right? Like it was almost like, we want to get away from like the big steeple churches, right? We want people, you know, like there was, you know, all the different bands that were having huge shows out on fields and like, but it's just like real and it's raw and people are doing life together, right? And so your story, it's like, it's just a hair off of what we were all being taught in growth things. You know, you go to Catalyst and you hear about skateboarding ministries and you're like, what, I can skateboard for the Lord? Like all these things, like, of course you'd start a media company and all the different company ideas that we had to create something. And it wasn't necessarily in a bad, the intentions, I'm not saying your leader's intentions were great, but the intentions of those who are doing the on the ground work is actually hoping to like make people, like when you're meeting people who are moving into a community, I bet half the people were thinking, oh, you know, it's really hard to move. This is going to be an opportunity for people to find what we think is a healthy community. And that's like, just like, I just watched the Netflix thing on Twin Flames. Mm-hmm. And the Twin Flames cult.
And yes, that's
and fun. What the intention, what you're saying makes a lot of sense because it's filling that need that a lot of that kind of stuff fills, which is like, people are lonely. It's an epidemic. And we've got an interesting and creative way of fulfilling that. And for those of us that maybe didn't fit into the steeple church, here's an opportunity. And then it goes south. And then you realize, like you said, we're just, I can't help but think of Arrested Development, like just a little bit of tax fraud. just a little.
Well, and the justification, right? One of the most, like, I think life-changing things for me coming out of this, which I still haven't kind of gotten to, and you asked, Justin, and I apologize, but like,
oh, you're fine.
Like now looking back is like the way, so I was so idealistic and so obviously young and naive going into this. And then the way that I slowly justified more and more dishonesty and more and more, I get why people, like why these people who are running these big farces of ministries, like get to that point where they're essentially fleecing people for their money. And it feels like just, you know, just raw, unadulterated greed. And in many cases it is, but I get why people justify it early on and how that's a very slow process of, I remember my leader coming to me, for instance, and like, I was a believer in like, this is what we're doing is, you know, I heard the voice of God tell me that we're supposed to be here. We're supposed to be reaching these people, whatever it might be. Right. I believed so much in the mission. And then I remember him coming to me and saying like, hey, people are losing hope. You know, people are losing hope. We're behind on this project. And so like, he gave me this money to put in the mailbox at our compound. And he was like, I want you to put it in there. And then we're going to pray that God would come through. And then we're going to go down and we're going to open the mailbox. And there's going to be this money that's there. And it's going to be an answer to prayer. And we would manufacture these things. And I justified that, like, sure, I'll be a part of basically lying to people about God showing up, because I believed God really wanted to show up and we just needed to help get people to believe that. And so if we could manufacture a miracle, we could get people to believe. And if people really believed, then God really would show up and then we would see things change. And then you all of a sudden now you're just a liar.
Yeah, you're complicit. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're part of it.
But you have to believe that, like, that's justified. Like, I'm justifying it because there's a greater good that's going to come from it. And that's such a slow process of being sucked into this machine that's like, well, too many people are relying. If we don't get people to believe and we don't get people to give, then this whole thing's going to fall apart. Everyone who's given their lives to this are going to lose everything. And so, like, it's my responsibility to keep everything afloat and going.
Oh, it's that the idea of I've already given so much. It's like the idea that if I just keep giving, eventually this investment is going to pay off. But then you realize, okay, but I've given so much. Eventually this is going to pay off. Well, we are going to take a brief break and then we are going to come back, because obviously there's a lot to unpack here, Courtland. I laugh because it makes me nervous, but if there is a lot to unpack.
Me too.
All right, we'll take a brief break and we'll be back soon.
Thanks, everybody, for enjoying that little break. So, Courtland, so all this has happened. This feels like we're at the point in the Netflix documentary where, like, they start doing, like, the somber, like, music, and it's, like, you know, B-roll footage of you walking by some, like, urban pond or something.
Yeah, that didn't happen when we only had one shower. I would have thought the music started then. No.
Yeah. Well, you know, but so we're at the point where this music is playing, and then now it's like, okay, what was, you've had this kind of like, I've got my kids, we've got one shower, we're, you know, like, and you make the shift from like, we're in ministry,
we're
to
money,
we're homeless.
Yeah.
Like, what happens now?
Yeah. So there was several times throughout that we had been in, like, just these very extreme situations of, like, I lived in unfinished garages and basements and tents and, you know, lots of different things. And this was like, I had lost belief in like the mission, right? Like I didn't feel like I had pretty much officially broken up with God. And
oh, interesting.
Did you have something?
No, I was just that. No. Sorry, I made a face. Just interesting that like part of it too was you were still in the midst of this really high investment situation. Yeah. And you're no longer invested in the overall, like what you're doing this for.
Like, I firmly believed that like the divine had like physically told me to be there and doing these things. Like I was a huge believer in like the divine calling that I had to be there. And that made justifying lots of things very easy. Lots of really terrible things that I was complicit in, lots of things that I was experiencing, that I was seeing people experience, justifying a lot of abuse and things that were happening around me because there was this divine purpose and this reason for me to be, you know, there. And kind of like what Sarah said, this sunk cost, like I had invested my whole life in this thing at that point. And so we ended up getting evicted from that building. We all kind of spread out. We didn't have a lot of people around us, but there were like a few older couples that were still kind of under the spell of this leader that was our, you know, senior pastor, leader, visionary person. And they were still believers in him and again, this mission and whatever. And so I kind of had to continue this, I didn't believe it anymore, but I had to continue to like kind of sell that there was, you know, we were going to rise from the ashes, so to speak. And we were going to have this, whatever, all this stuff that had happened to us was going to be some part of our story that would make our ministry, our impact even greater in the future. Somehow we were going through this struggle again. I had stopped believing personally. And this is where it got hard because like I had to like, before I would lie, but it didn't feel like lying because I believed in what I was selling. Mm-hmm. And now I was like, I don't believe it anymore, but like, I literally don't have anywhere to live if you don't take me in. And I don't think you're going to take us in if you don't think that we're still pursuing, you know, the Lord.
Oh, it just has so many implications.
Yeah. A parsonage will do that to you too. Like,
yeah, it's like your livelihood, right? Like, well, we're going to be on the street or we're going to continue to believe in.
Yeah, this isn't just my job. This is my home. This is my family's home. You know, even if it's not like a secure situation, it's like, well, it's something.
So we moved into a room, a basement room with an older couple who had been very invested in our son's life and had kind of been like adoptive grandparents to him, so to speak. They took him a lot and like kind of like treated him like their own kind of grandkid. And they let us move into their basement. We lived there for a while and with them. And there was a couple who was an older retired couple who had, you know, been big funders of the ministry up until that point, who had a business that they, you know, needed help with. And we had all of these skills from doing all of these failed businesses that were part of our ministry. You know, I knew how to build a website. I knew how to do social media. We knew how to do videos and media and photos. And they were like, would you guys kind of like come on board and, you know, we can like use this business to kind of get you guys back up on your feet. And that just became the next con, right? Like,
oh,
so
no.
These poor people lost everything because their business got basically taken by our group that did the same thing we did with everything else. We overpromised, underdelivered, blamed somebody else, you know, the classic con. But that business gave me a place to get a little space, gave me a little bit of pay. Up until that point, I had never been paid a dollar. Like we did not get paid, right? So like technically, according to the US government, my entire adulthood up until 26, I made $0 and was on you know, Medicaid and food stamps and SNAP, and we did not get paid money. We would be given food or money to like do certain things, but it was like very all controlled by the leader of this group. And so when we started, you know, helping with the business, this business, they started paying us small amounts. We were making, Crystal and I were making, I think, like, I don't know, like $1,500 a month or something like that at first. And that was like life changing for us. Like that was like, we could buy wow. groceries, or we could like, you know, I don't know, you know, we bought a car and like, you know, like mm-hmm. we got an apartment eventually. And we were still working with all of these people. The leader of, you know, the former church was kind of running this business, stealing this business, sadly, from this kind of poor old couple who had offered it as a lifeboat for us. And yeah, I spent about a year in that business until I finally had the other relationships and the network, the personal network, to be like, yeah, I'm gonna leave. And even then it was pretty tough, because what would end up happening was anybody who left would become the person who was the cause of whatever was happening, right? So like, you know, we're going to, you know, back in the church days, right? We're going to do this thing. We rent out a building, or we sign a lease for a building. We get a donor to give us $10,000 or $20,000 to do this. We spend that $10,000 or $20,000 paying off some debt from an old project that didn't go well. We can't then pay the bill for the new project that we just sold. The donors, a staff member realizes, oh, this is unethical. They leave. And then we basically like low key run a whisper campaign to blame that leaving staff member and say they stole money or they caused some issue to why this new venture mm-hmm. didn't work. So I became that same thing, right? When I left, it was, oh, you know, the business is failing because Cortland, you know, stole a bunch of money or took clients or, you know, whatever. And I knew that would happen. I knew that I would basically lose all relationship with all of the people involved in that when I decided to leave, which did happen.
Mm-hmm. That's one of the pain points for most, like a common denominator with a lot of the stories we hear is like, you even stay a little bit longer because you know what will happen once you leave, and you can't avoid it for a lot of these communities. Again, my story was very different. People were awesome and stayed in my life, but in a different way, for sure. I can't imagine how much longer you stay when it means losing everything, you know, losing, even though they're really unhealthy relationships, losing unhealthy relationships is still a loss when, like you said, you're for the first time learning how to like have money, which is like a thing that people, it's not a small thing to say, for the first time we're making a salary, and now we have to figure out like, what does that mean? What does that look like? How do I pay taxes? What does that look like? How do I pay my rent? What do you mean I have to figure out gas and electric and all that sort of stuff? Like when you've never been taught that, it is mm-hmm. a scary thing. And then to think you're losing all of your community, it makes sense why you stayed.
Well, and there had been several people who had come and gone throughout, you know, and the worst part of, I think, leaving what would be like leaving all of these people in, not only that you're going to leave them and they're not going to talk to you anymore, they're going to basically cut you off and think that you are this evil like cause of some sort of problem in their life, but like you cannot, like we would have people leave and then write letters and be like, you're in a cult and you need to get out, and we would just be like, oh no, like they're obviously like they're disgruntled because of all these bad mm-hmm. things that they did and all this, you know, there was no way for them to get to reach us. Like you just had to save yourself, you know, like, and each person along the way who ended up leaving, now I've reconnected with several of those people since. And it's been interesting because like the organization is no longer around. And
that was going to be my actually next question. It's like, is it around? Did you watch it blow up after you left? Did anyone face any sort of, you know, no. I need closure. like I hate no. that at the end of Twin Flames are like, oh, and they're still around. And you're like, wait, what? Sorry, that was a spoiler.
Yeah. You're like, they're
you
still
Google
going.
It, you'll see they're still
it's
going.
Still tied up. Which is great because I need to find my twin flame. No, I'm just kidding. So the business that we were in ended up, I believe the guy, the leader, I believe he raised somewhere close to like $1 million or $1.5 million in investment, which was like totally fraudulently raised, ended up selling that to an investment company who like got totally fleeced. Those investors I've stayed somewhat in touch with. They ended up selling the business after that for like a loss. And then that guy ended up going, and I don't want to talk about wherever he's no longer a person that's involved in anything that I think is a threat to anybody. And nobody who I knew at the time is involved with him, but they're a ton of people still got hurt after I left. There were still a bunch of things that happened that hurt a lot of people after leaving. But I think that's pretty much cycled down at this point.
What would you say to folks who are listening to this story and going, wow, I can resonate. I might not be like, oh, I didn't commit tax fraud, but I know what it's like to be in a high control situation, or they have a family member in a high control situation. Cause you said something there that was really quite meaty and we ran by it pretty quick, which was like, no one from the outside could reach us. And we had to, and once we left, we couldn't reach those that were still in. And I think that's one of the most disheartening things you hear is like, you become so separated from other people. For folks, like what would you say is sort of a sense of like, for people who maybe they're watching a family member go through this, maybe they've come out of it themselves, like what has been grounding for you? What has been helpful? Because it does sound like you've reconnected with some of these people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was two of the couples that were involved in this were over at my house today, and we're still very close friends. But yeah, I mean, I think it's like there is no, you watch these documentaries. I don't know if you guys watch, you mentioned Twin Flames. We just had the Mother God.
Oh, yeah.
You guys watch the Mother God.
It's my next one. After the Great British Baking Show, I'm Mother Godding it.
I didn't watch that one. I watched Wild Wild Country, and that was okay.
That one concerned me because I got three episodes in before I was like, oh, I couldn't do this. But it was like three episodes in. So I'm like a three episode cult member.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There. So you watch these things and it is like there is no way, like if somebody truly believes, like you just do your best to, you know, be there for people and realize that coming out of something like that, there's so much shame from being involved in it. Mm-hmm. Like the things that I feel responsible and culpable for being involved in that are like, I will be unpacking things that I don't like about myself for the rest of my life, you know, that I didn't catch, I didn't, you know, realize the amount of harm that came. It's really hard to come out of those organizations. And even for those, Janice Legata, when she talked about who's the sexy Hillsong pastor who had a scandal in New York?
Carl Lentz.
I knew it, but I wanted Sarah to jump in and say it.
Did I visualize him when I said it? Maybe.
Yeah.
I saw the camera. I was like, I'm good. I could say Carl Lentz, but I want to give this to Sarah.
I couldn't think of the sunk cost, but I could think of Carl Lentz. I don't know what that says about me.
That's fine. I thought of
Carl Lentz's name before I usually think of my name. So there's that.
You're not wrong.
There is obviously like this is not meant to like absolve him of responsibility in the harm that he caused, but this is to say like he was he is a victim of this system.
Absolutely.
That sucks people in to these machines like Hillsong and like Willow Creek and like Mars Hill and like, you know, like all of these giant institutions, Acts 29, and you know, and you get sucked into this machine and it is miserable. Like it is miserable to be in that machine. And there is so much shame to come out of that.
Right.
and you feel like, well, what now? What do I do? How do people? I mean, we saw what happened with, and again, not to make these people victims, but what happened with Josh Harris, mm-hmm. and like, you know, the backlash that he caught for good mm-hmm. reason when he was like slinging his, you know, deconstruction course or whatever, whatever. But also like this man is most likely like really feeling a lot of guilt and shame around, and was basically groomed into this role as a right. very, very young person to be the spokesperson for this purity culture message. I mean, he was not like, he did not realize what he was doing at 19, 20 years old when he was being groomed to be this voice for purity. And I look back at my story and I feel like there's so much shame. And I like, that's really hard for people coming out of especially abusive high control environments.
Well, and that's kind of how it works as well, because then you've become involved in it. So you're complicit. And then it makes it one of the things I was very fascinated with the twin flame stuff was making people coaches. And maybe I'm a little bit sensitive to that. We talked about that last week. But as someone who does do that sort of consulting and coaching work, and you realize that these people have so much guilt and shame for how they started slinging that themselves. And then there's like, I stopped believing in it, but I needed for my financial, like you were sharing. And then that shame of that, and knowing that when they knew they were starting to harm people, and so then they back away, and there's all that guilt, the people you leave behind. And I think your story in a weird way, not in a weird way, I shouldn't have said in a weird way, your story actually is one that is inspiring for people who have come out of it. Because I see the ways that you have sought to be honest about what you went through, what you were a part of, and give yourself and those involved some grace. Because there is nothing that isn't true about being groomed into something and participating in something. And I talk about this a little bit. I think sometimes men are, this is not to make excuses for the Carlinses and the Joshua Harrises, but I will say that we created them and told them that they didn't matter if they weren't an expert. Like, you don't matter at all if you're not in the front saying the things that you need to say. And so then we're both building you up, but then creating like a very shaky ground. But at any moment you could lose it all, because you need to be like up here doing the thing. And I think that's the high control that you experience, where if you weren't participating in the thing and involved in the thing, everything would be gone. It was so shaky. And then how do you build a healthy sense of self out of that? And then how do you not have shame follow you around or fear of like, I'm going to get involved in this thing again? You know, I think it's fascinating to me that obviously this twin flames thing really hit me, but that some of the family members of people who are out, the people who are out won't talk about it, but their family members did. And they allowed their family members to. They were just like, I can't address it even. That's how close it is to me.
Yeah. And you see this with institutions who lose big leaders. So so funny enough, during my time in this cult, evangelical church plant culture, we were somehow very good at like getting in rooms with people and connecting. I once hung out with Bill Hybels in his boathouse for an interview that we did about Global Leadership Summit for Christianity Today. I became pretty good friends with Ted Haggard during this time. And this was post scandal Ted Haggard, and did several events with Ted and, you know, several other kind of disgraced ministers. But you look at like what continues to happen with organizations like New Life after Ted is gone, and they still continue to be harmful institutions.
Yeah.
So it's not like this, like, that's why I kind of like, don't like to focus on this one particular guy who obviously was like the leader of my particular high control environment. And we could just say, oh, it's just him. Like, it's his fault. He's like the, you know, villain of this story, but it's these systems, it's these institutions that are in and of themselves breeding grounds for harm and abuse and high mm-hmm. control. And sure, these instruments like Brian Houston, but Brian Houston, you know, his dad started that whole thing. Right. He came along later. Carl Lentz came along later into the Hillsong machine. you know, the New Life Machine. Ted Haggard, you know, got excommunicated from Colorado Springs. There's a documentary that you can watch, Trials of Ted Haggard, on like his post-scandal situation where him and Gail had to go live in New Mexico or something. Like, but New Life continues. Like, and that doesn't, just getting rid of this one person is, does not fix these abusive institutions, these harmful institutions mm-hmm. that continue to run. It's not about just rooting out the bad apples. Institutionally, these systems are in and of themselves harming people. And we cannot make it about just, you know, getting rid of these particular, you know, that's like this SBC thing, right? It's not just about getting rid of these few people. The whole system is corrupt. The whole system is, well, is wired up to be harmful.
And they're just making a list of those people too. They're not getting rid of them.
They're not even getting rid of them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good point.
It's interesting. Like, I think it was, I think like Pete Rollins, like talked about these, like these things that are kind of like ghosts, you know, people that leave, but they're still there. And like when you can name the reality, they, you know, can become holy ghosts. They can become good things in your, but when you don't name them, when you shove them down, they just kind of become poltergeists that are just banging around, you know, and you're in the kitchen and like, you know, pots and pans are flinging around. You're like, well, what's going on? You know, but it's like this system just keeps moving. And then, you know, people, like once they wake up, they can choose to continue to participate or they can, you know, choose to, I'm going to go back to sleep again. And I'm sure Courtland, as you, if you're looking back, you're like, there was probably a series of awakenings, you know, there might have even been something way back when you were like 17, 18, where you're like, you're like, nah, I'll just keep going, you know, and we all do it. We've all done that, you know? And so like, it's just eventually there's that one thing that finally it snaps. And then it's like, holy crap, I saw the whole thing the whole time. But it's when you're in that, when you're in the system, you know, like we're not solitary animals. You know, we belong in packs, we belong in groups, we're social creatures. Like, you know, humans will pair bond with anything, you know, like, so it's interesting because it's like, you want to kind of name a person because it helps it make a little more sense. Like if it's like, oh, this person was just really manipulative and, but no, actually like they were part of it too. And there was some kind of consciousness created amongst us that just was deeply unhealthy and hurt all of us, you know, just some were more culpable than others. And I think that's a healthy way to look at it because in some ways it lets you exercise it too. Because then you get to be like, you can be the perpetrator and ask for forgiveness and make amends, but you can also like rightfully take on the role of, I was a victim of this too, you know? And I think that's an important thing to, an important journey to go on for sure.
Yeah. And I think you're right to critique a system versus just a person. Because if we just critique a person, it is easy to say once they're gone. And like you say, it continues and we have to look at it and give ourselves some space and like notice the things. And then I'm grateful for you telling your story, honestly, Courtland, because I think people need to hear that sometimes things that looked really good were just not. And doesn't mean there aren't great things out there. It just means that we have to keep our eyes open and honesty and be honest with ourselves and others. And I think that's something that we're watching happen quite a bit right now is that there's a reckoning of a lot, hopefully, of some people getting really honest about, you know, religious settings that take advantage of people. And I think that's the one thing documentaries are doing a really interesting thing, which is hopefully highlighting some of the things that were hidden and in the dark and not known. So I'm grateful for you for being willing to come on and share your story a little bit. I know there's so much, like there's so many questions I want to ask, but I'm grateful for you just even revealing this little part. Is there anything you want to share as sort of like a last, like, hey, whatever to our listeners? And then we'll ask where folks can find you because you have a very interesting podcast that people can listen to and hear more, I'm sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't talk about my story on the podcast or virtually anywhere. And it is hard to talk about because I do feel like there's so much left out. And there's also still like so many people who were impacted that I still like haven't been able to, like, I don't know where they're at, you know? I mean, we took hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars probably from people, and on top of just like the other harm and abuse and stuff, just the financial abuse that that ended up happening. And so it's hard to know exactly how to talk about it, but I appreciate you giving me space to talk about it a little bit, because I think, like you said, with these documentaries that we're seeing, with more of us seeing friends and families being sucked up into extremist ideologies. I know my parents, for instance, have become way more extreme in their homophobia, in their transphobia, in their conservative ideals in the last few years. You know, like, you know, we were not, I look at my parents now and I'm like, we weren't anti-vaxxers. We weren't this homophobic. I mean, we were fundamentalists, but we weren't this obsessed with trans people. Like, what happened? Like, obviously you've been sucked up into this cultural identity of extremism via, you know, new era Trump politics. But as we see people being sucked up into these things, these extremist, you know, views and groups, it's important for us to like understand psychologically like how there is ways for them to get out and and think differently and not always be involved in these systems of harm.
And there is a life thereafter.
So I knew you were gonna do it. Justin Perfect. Was just like, I knew he was gonna do it. I just had to hop in.
Perfect.
So that, if you're wondering, that is the name of Cortland's podcast that he does, and it is with Megan, actually, who we've also had on the podcast. Thereafter is the name of the podcast, and you want to give a little bit of a background on what Thereafter is about?
Yeah, I mean, it's evolved kind of over time, but it was my. So like after kind of getting out of this whole thing, I spent a couple years just not thinking about anything religious related. Just like I said, I needed a couple years of smoking weed and sitting on my couch and not, you know, thinking about church or ministry or anything. And then I began, you know, finding accounts and listening to some podcasts and realizing like there's still a big piece of me. I identify as an atheist, but I'm one of the weirdest atheists you'll ever meet because I still love theology and Christianity and religion in general, faith communities.
I think you're more Christian than I am.
Yeah.
Easily.
Yeah, I think that is not probably untrue. And so yeah, the podcast was a way for me to start, you know, kind of like having conversations with people in these spaces of post-evangelicalism, post-fundamentalism that were still doing interesting things or, you know, saying stuff that I thought was important, whether it was about coming out of it or whether it was about a new type of or a different type of theology, you know. So we interviewed, you know, people like Damon Garcia, who, you know, talk about liberation theology, or Mason Meninga, who, you know, talks about theology. But we also interview people who are not people of faith, or who have left other different faith traditions as well. So it's a pretty wide group of people that we talk to on the show. And I, like you said, I do it with Megan Crozier. I consider it really her podcast, and I co-host it. She does a lot of the legwork these days.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Cortland. And thank you so much for sharing a bit of your story. And friends, thank you so much for listening. So we will catch you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode. If you are enjoying the conversations you hear on RevCovery, you can continue the conversation with us and many more incredible people in the RevCovery room on Discord. To access our Discord, please join our Patreon to become part of the RevCovery room community. You can join for as little as $4 a month, and this helps us produce the show as well as gives you access to the community resources. Check it out at www.patreon.com/RevCovery. We know that not everyone is able to financially support the show, but there are lots of ways to support us, including giving us a 5-star review wherever you're listening right now. And make sure to like and subscribe across all social media. Revcovery Room is our Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook handle, so you can find us there to keep the conversation going. Now on to some final thoughts and this week's poem.
Friends, thanks for sticking around for the quote or sometimes a poem. We do both at the end. As always, this is just a time to sort of debrief the conversation that we've had. And oftentimes, Justin and I talk about how it's through quotes or poems or song lyrics that we ourselves have been able to process things. As I thought about the conversation with Cortland, I think the thing that struck me is how many people are walking around feeling as if something defines them, a past identity. And so I thought about the book Love in the Time of Cholera, actually. So this is a quote from that book from Gabriel Garcia Marquez. And so this is a quote that, I don't know, reminded me of Cortland and the way that Cortland has decided to move forward. He allowed himself to be swayed by his conviction that human beings are not born once and for all on the day their mothers give birth to them, but life obliges them over and over again to give birth to themselves. Friends, however it is that you have been defined in the past, may you have the courage and the boldness to go forward, giving birth to yourself again and again. Have a great week, friends. We'll catch you next week.